Okay, while we're getting set up here, I just have a few introductory comments before I introduce Gail, who will introduce our speakers. One of the categories that we say the Adult Forum is interested in, along with Bible study, church history, liturgy, doctrine, whatever, is social issues. So I look back over about the past 2 years, and John was asking, do you do this sort of thing often? In the last 2 years, we've had sessions on racism, healthcare reform, workers' rights, and clean energy. And today and next week, the social issue that we're looking at is maybe the most volatile of all of these, and that is gun safety, gun violence, and gun legislation. But we're pleased that the tenor of this group is to have respectful and thoughtful listening and questioning. And that set the stage, I think, for all of our sessions, no matter what the subject is. And I will ask, Gail Hafer is the one who set up this program for us today, so I will turn it over to her.
He used the word speaker.
There's something about a mic that, you know, in the rest of the time I can pretend that I speak quietly enough, no one actually hears me. So before we begin this discussion, I just want to tell you just a tiny bit of background unrelated to this specific issue. I'm reading this book, Think Again, How to Reason and Argue, by this person whose name I'm not going to attempt to pronounce. It's a relatively new book, but my library had it, so I suspect it's coming out quickly. It was an effort on his part, primarily a philosopher, to talk about not only how we make arguments, but why we should make arguments. And I think in this time period post-Trump, it's kind of interesting to think about how we make arguments. And because we're going to make arguments today, I thought it provided a nice background for this conversation. So these are the things that he talks about in the first part of the book about the value of argumentation that I thought were useful to me, and so I'm sharing them. The first thing he talks about is that we tend to live in communities of like-minded individuals. So I think this group can probably agree that for the most part that's true. With this group specifically, it's certainly true in the world I live in at work. That we tend to believe that we know why other people hold the opinions they do when they hold opinions that are different than ours, but we're not really interacting with them very much, and so we're not talking to them about why they hold those opinions. That we lose some things because we don't interact and argue with these people, and he means argument in a very formal sense. That we're less able to see the weaknesses in our own positions if we don't hear the arguments and positions of others, especially people that just have a wide diversity of opinions. And that we lose the possibility of finding that we have essential beliefs and common goals toward which we might work together. And so this is a chance to hear from people who might have a very different perspective than some of you have about gun ownership. Next week you're going to hear from the Moms Organization, and they have a very interesting approach to their legislative action. I worked for a while with some people at Children's Hospital who took a very narrow approach to guns, which was, if you have a gun, you bring it into your home, you unload it, and you lock it up. That was their whole goal. And those sorts of things might be common beliefs that we could find as we have these discussions. So they're not here to actually cause you to change your mind, but to help you think about where we might find commonality. So these two people I chose for a very specific reason, because, he could say no. He tried to say no.
You have an in.
But I chose them because they are like us. For many of you, one of these people is someone you've eaten dinner with before. So let me tell you what you might or might not know about Rick. He wrote me this long thing. For anybody who doesn't know, Rick is my husband. We've been married for 39 years. That's a little scary. Yeah, I know. We met in graduate school. He has a PhD in economics. He spent the first 10 years that we were here in St. Louis at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Board, or St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. They can't even talk yet. Unlike some of you, I have not had enough tea yet. He left the Fed to go to SIUE. He was there for just a little less than 30 years. He's been at Lindenwood now for 2 years, where he's the director of the Center for Economics and the Environment. He'll tell you lots of other things he's done and places he's been. His goal when he graduated from Virginia Tech was to have more articles always published than he is old. I'm fairly sure, even at 65, he's still there. This is his friend John DeLuca. John and his wife Marie have been married for 53 years. They have 4 boys and 11 grandchildren. John went to the University of Illinois, where he ended with, after some engineering and mathematics, ended with a PhD in solid state chemistry, which to me sounds scary. I'm more a social science person. He spent time at Oak Ridge Laboratory, at Exxon, where he worked on developing automotive catalysts, at Monsanto in the improvement of semiconductors, with MEMC in their research and development team, and then co-founded Confluence Solar, which was a part of developing high-efficiency solar cells. He's got lots of patents, lots of articles, and spends all of his time now, he says, enjoying grandchildren making furniture and shooting sports. I wonder if you put that on there just for me. He and Marie are part of Ascension Parish in Chesterfield. I've asked them if they would just, as a preliminary, tell you a little bit about the guns they have, how they take care of them, how they perhaps were introduced to guns, and how they've introduced their children to guns, a little bit about gun safety, maybe a little bit about the kinds of gun legislation that they would be open to, and then they're going to let you ask questions. Remember that Rick can really talk. So, please raise your hand if you'd like a turn.
Already? I haven't started yet.
Do we have to reason and argue, or can we shout and scream?
No.
It depends if you want me to ever come back again.
Whoa.
So I'll know, right? He's my friend.
I can. Well, thank you for having me here this morning. Let me lead off by saying I'm a very non-confrontational person. I really don't argue or scream at anybody, and I have no expectations of changing your mind. That's absolutely not my intention. Now, about guns. I've grown up with guns. I was encouraged to hunt when I was small. Small rabbits when I was young, and I grew up enjoying gun, and right now I do a lot of competitive shooting. Okay, first of all, I have a lot of guns, so they range all the way from handguns through rifles, and I compete in handguns, I compete in shotguns, and I compete in rifles. These guns are from very inexpensive to very expensive guns. I keep them locked up in a safe. I always have. I have no loaded guns in the house. I don't have any guns in the house other than in the safe. So I have a permit to carry a gun, but I never do. I'm frightened to carry a gun, to be honest with you. You usually get in trouble if you do. You take on more risk if you do that. But I think one of the things that I've seen is particularly ladies that I know are frightened and they choose to have a gun. So I enjoy them very much so. For gun safety, I've stressed that obviously with my, I have 4 sons, as Gail said, and we shoot together. In some fun times, some very interesting time. I have one son who is opposed to gun ownership. I have two that are avid shooters. We hunt together. We hunt small bird, upland birds. And let's see, what else can I say? I enjoy shooting sports. Okay.
He enjoys shooting sports, craft, ski, things like that. But I think like John, I grew up in Omaha, not on a farm. John grew up in rural southern Illinois. I grew up in Omaha.
Hey, Brent, will you see if that's actually turned on?
Just tap it.
No, it's not.
Where's my AV guy?
There we go. You're good.
I can tell. It's okay.
Okay, good, thanks.
And most of my father's relatives lived on the farm, so we had a real attachment to rural, you know, sort of rural America. And it was, you know, it was a tradition. Beginning of 1st of November, you would go pheasant hunting, and that meant you would go down to Uncle Orville's farm, and you would start there. You would see Uncle Morris, and it was more of a social event than it really was a hunting event. The goal was not to and I think John would agree with this in hunting, it's not really, you know, to get something to eat necessarily as much as it is the social event, and that's a bonding event. And if you've never done it, it's as John said, it's impossible to convince someone about hunting. But when it comes to shooting, you know, I like John, we were counting up how many guns we have, and so this some part of the statistical problem is that if you count up how many guns we have and then you divide how many guns we have by all of you, every one of you out there has at least one gun. And then that's the statistic, is that there's a lot of us who have multiple guns for a variety of reasons. One is because in shooting sports, there's different gauges. You have 12 gauge, 20 gauge, 28 gauge, 410. So if you shoot skeet, you oftentimes have four guns just to shoot one sport, because there's different things. And then, you know, if you've hunted in the past, you've somehow acquired a 22, a little 22 rifle. If you've hunted in the past, you've somehow acquired another rifle. And a lot of times, and I've acquired two guns just because somebody cleaned out their attic, knew I shot, and just gave me their guns. And they just were going to get rid of them, and I was the person to get rid of them too. So you acquire guns over time, depending on different people. And I, like John, you know, my guns are all in a gun safe. It's not only in a gun safe, it's a gun safe that's hidden away, so you know, most of you would never find it. But it's one of the things that I've been impressed by is that, so John and I shoot at what's called the St. Louis Skeet and Trap Club, and it's out on Old 66, and weirdly enough, it's located across in Missouri, it's the prison out there next to Pacific. That's where, across the street from there. And I've shot up there for 10 years or so, maybe. I think you've been up there about as long or a little bit longer.
Not longer.
And one of the things I'm always impressed by is how much of an emphasis there is on gun safety. Guns are, and to the extent that if we're shooting on one, so there's different fields, and if we're shooting on one field and we see somebody who's new shooting on another field doing something that we think is unsafe, it's not uncommon at all for somebody in our group or somebody in another group to go down there and tell them either to change what they're doing or to leave the club. And we get some looks like that from people. But it's so important to emphasize safety that that's just the way the club operates, and that's the way that the membership of the club that we think is really, really important. So, you know, it's safety to such an extent that so we have gun racks. So if my gun's racked up and John says, and everybody never picks a gun up from somebody else's gun without asking permission. It's one of those weird things. But I think it's an indication of how safety conscious most gun owners are, you know, responsible gun owners. And you would never give somebody a gun without checking to see if it's loaded, even though you know it's not. And so our guns are over under, so that you break them open, you can see if there's anything in it. And you would never give somebody a gun without taking your own gun, breaking it open and seeing if it's empty. And you always hand somebody a broken open gun. You always hand somebody a gun that has, the action is open, so that it's not closed. And that's just the way we do it. And And it may not be the way people do it when they start at the club, but within a very short period of time, that's what you learn to do. And for me, and I'm sure for John, that's what you were trained, that's what you were taught when you were a kid. That when you're out hunting and you cross a fence, you always open your gun. When you move from someplace to someplace else, if there's any question, you always open your gun because, it's just the safe thing to do. And gun safety is just very, very important. Now, a lot of people out there are thinking, why do you own so many guns? This is a question we ask ourselves. Now, the better question to ask John is, John does woodworking. And if you think woodworking, you think you got like a table saw and a bandsaw. And now John makes very high-end furniture. And we were talking the other night, knowing we were coming here, and John right. said, how many woodworking tools do I have? And you said?
Well, almost an infinite number. But what I mentioned is, I use a lot of hand tools. So I told Rick, I said, I counted up how many hand planes that I have. And I have almost 40. And you say, well, what the heck do you need 40 hand planes? The answer is, each tool, each thing has a very specific purpose. So if you want to do a rabbit on one thing, or a dado, or a mortise, a tenon, whatever you want to do, it takes a different tool. Same thing with guns. If you want to compete in skeet, it takes a set of guns. If you trap, it takes several guns. Same way with sporting clays. Same way with long-range rifle shooting. I shoot, from 100 yards to 1,000 yards. So we compete in that. So every gun that I have has a particular purpose. So the tools go up, almost exponentially at the beginning. But so that's why I have a variety of guns, So you may think, well, Angie, that's sort of strange, but that's what I do.
And I think that one of the things is that, not all guns are alike. So we both have different guns. And so, you can get an entry-level gun. So it's like golf. Just think about golf. You can buy an entry-level set of clubs for $500. You can buy an upper-end set of clubs for $4,000. Now, guns, the range is a little different. But you can probably get into shooting for, you can find a $500 gun. Or you can have a $30,000 gun. And you say, well, why in the world would anybody have a gun that costs $30,000? Because it's engineered to such a precise level. It's engraved. It's they don't make many of them. I mean, think about, I don't know if you all collect anything. If you're a collector of something, think about people who collect porcelain dolls or with Hummel. Those porcelain figurines. It'd be like asking somebody, why do you have more than one? If you have one, many of you have been in our house, why do we have more than one piece of artwork hanging on the wall? Well, because they're all different, we like them, and a lot of people collect guns. We have somebody, a mutual acquaintance, I wouldn't say friend necessarily, but a mutual acquaintance of ours, who has on his property out by Columbia, Missouri, has a little, what looks like a little house, and I think originally was a house, and he has a collection, he has a collection that is, it's like Jay Leno has 150 cars or something like that. Ralph probably has, I don't know how many guns. But his collection is not just guns. He's got a collection of guns that has certain aspects about the serial numbers, that the serial numbers have to be this. And so, you know people who collect things who get, what to the rest of us would be like, why do you have 150 Hummel figurines? Well, because this one's special, this one's different. And there are people who collect guns in the same way. And I think it's strange. And a lot of other people think it's strange, but it's what they do. And oftentimes they don't even shoot them. They just collect them to be claimed, like people collect artwork. So guns in and of themselves are really no different in a lot of ways. The way we think about guns for sporting purposes, and a lot of people collect them just as collectible pieces.
Yeah, and let me add, this guy Ralph that has, he has an awful lot of guns in our tour is a vault, you might say. And his wife Marianne says that's her retirement money. And it truly is. It's some guns that I have, and certainly what Ralph has, have gone up in value a lot. Okay, so, you know, another reason that some people collect guns. Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know what else we can say. Let's just go ahead and open it up. Yeah.
Well, you're bringing up about responsible guns ownership, but there's a huge gun problem in our country. Can you address that? How we can handle that? The mass shootings, the killings every day?
Well, I mean, to some extent, that's an area in which I was hoping we wouldn't jump right to, because it's weird. Just as gun owners, I think to the large part, are just as concerned about it as non-gun owners, and it's too easy to say, well, we could get rid of the problem if we just eliminated guns, and because that's I don't think that's going to happen. We've passed a number of laws. There's a number of cities who have very stringent gun ownership laws that it's just not working. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't try somehow. I don't know how you succeed. I think there are, I'm totally in favor, I won't speak for John, like I'm not a member of the NRA. I don't like the NRA. I don't like the positions they've taken. The NRA have morphed over time from what used to be a very good gun ownership organization to a lobbying group now that is not very representative, I think, of a lot of people who own guns. There are other groups, I think, that are better than that. But I think one of the issues is, so I don't mind not having, they've talked about reducing magazines that have how many bullets you can have in a magazine. I don't have any problem with a lot of those kind of regulations. Now you say, well, why don't you just get rid of certain kinds of guns? Well, because there are people who like to shoot those kinds of guns. I mean, it's hard to explain, but there are people, and unless you've done it, if I took you out to, there's an indoor range in Manchester where you can go out and you can shoot an automatic rifle. So you pull the trigger and it fires, so like a machine, not quite a machine gun, but sort of like that. And if you've never, I've been out there with people who've never shot before, and they do it, and they go, wow, this is really kind of cool. And it's like you drive a car, and then you get in a sports car, and you go, wow, this is really kind of cool. And so it's not to say that we shouldn't have responsible laws, but responsible laws are that you just can't say, well, you know, that gun was used in this crime, therefore we should eliminate that kind of gun. And as John said, I think there's a lot of people who have handguns, John has a handgun, who don't carry. You know, everybody thinks if you have a handgun that you're going to carry a handgun. And I think, I don't like handguns. I've shot them before, but I just don't like them whatever reason. They scare me a little bit. I would hope that none of you out there have a handgun on you right now. But do we know people, you know, when you walk down the street, yeah, there are people carrying handguns. But I think it's too difficult a problem to say, well, we're just going to eliminate guns and that'll solve the problem.
Yeah, let me add to your question there. I think to get rid of guns, to control guns, we have to take two approaches. One is a long-term approach, and one is a sort of a short-term approach. The long-term approach is going to be extremely difficult to handle. I mean, we will have to work on it. But the in anticipation of that very question, I studied the Supreme Court decisions. There have been three major decisions about guns, but hundreds of smaller ones. So, and they have confirmed very clearly in the Constitution, say that, you know, private ownership could, private individuals could own guns, okay? There was some time they interpreted, if you read the Second Amendment, had the word militia in there, and as recently as 2008, they made a very clear statement that you don't have to be in the militia to own a gun. So long term, we want to eliminate guns. We need to change the law. That's going to have to happen. That's whether you agree with the Second Amendment, most probably you don't agree with the Second Amendment, but it's there. That's the law. Now, short term, what we need to do is control the distribution of guns. But what I'm trying to say is, first of all, there's 300 million guns in the United States, estimated 300 million guns. Now, you can have all kinds of redemption programs. You know, you're just not going to get rid of them. And it's somewhat, in a way, it's sort of like drugs. We pass laws saying heroin is illegal, you know, but everybody can get heroin, okay? So the same thing with guns. We can outlaw guns, even if we, you know, the Second Amendment was repealed. You're not going to get all of them. And unfortunately, there's two classes of people that are very dangerous that get guns. One is the criminal, okay? And he will get guns all over the world. There's places that will sell you guns, you know. And the other one is those that are perhaps angry or mentally disturbed or mentally not capable of understanding what they're doing, that we somehow we have to get those guns out of their hands, okay? That brings you to a very tricky question. How do you decide somebody isn't worthy or capable or to allow a gun? So that's a lot of privacy there. You have to almost have a doctor talk about the capability of the person. And that gets into privacy very much. So it's going to be difficult. But we still need to try to get long-term and short-term guns out of most people's hands. Another aspect of that are schools. We need to really somehow eliminate school violence, okay? Now, there are a lot of guns, and it's going to, you know, essentially impossible to get rid of all of them. So I don't advocate that we have teachers with guns. Not at all. That would be just, I think, absolutely wrong. But I think we need to spend more time and effort and money on protecting the children with the schools. I mean, we spent, a lot of money protecting our banks, our money, okay? We spend very little money in protecting our children. So we need to improve that. There are many ways that should be done, but one of them is not putting guns in school with teachers, okay? So I don't know if that expands on the answer to your question or not. It's not good news,
So you are for people registering to have guns and they have to have there has to be some rule, like we register cars. Can't we register guns? And
yes, we could. That is opposed by a lot of gun owners because you value your privacy, and basically we don't trust the government, okay? So that's a big driver. We don't want to have somebody coming breaking into our house and taking our guns away because they're registered and they know about them. Okay? So we could, but what we should do is much stronger background checks. You know, this group, this you hear a lot about, you can transfer guns with no background check, you know? And that's absolutely wrong. We should have gut laws, strict laws, to control the transfer of guns from people that have them to the undesirable.
When you purchase a gun now, you do have to, it becomes registered. So it's, and then the problem about, it's about private transfer. So if John sells me a gun, the government, there's no evidence of that.
Right.
And that could be something that you would have to do.
There are loopholes, all right, in gun shows, and you can get it off the internet and make your own gun.
Yeah, that's true. The gun shows, that's a really a loophole, okay? So if I go to a gun show and I buy a gun from a dealer, I have to register it. I have not to do the check. But an individual, I don't have to do that. So, but that loophole should be fixed. That's a short-term thing that we can do And we have to think about, or at least I think about, we don't want to, we're not going to eliminate guns, but the fewer there are like that, the less the damage will be done, okay? So you won't save everybody, you won't eliminate it, but you'll have fewer people hurt with guns, okay? So.
Me? Okay.
Yeah.
In two things. Number one, I live in the city of Brentwood, and they passed this year a bill to improve the security of all the schools in Brentwood, so they are in doing that to make the mm-hmm. students a lot safer, which is good. Number two, there have been buyback programs to get guns off the street. Do you know if those have been at all effective in reducing crime rate or?
Certainly in Australia it's been effective because they have a.
What about here?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So there's examples where it's been successful. You know, I don't know of any buyback programs. Now they've had some voluntary turn-in programs, okay, where and then they were the guns were destroyed. But I don't know of any. Maybe Rick did.
Well, I think the city has some.
Does them,
yeah.
Almost annually, I think.
Yeah.
And I think your city does.
The city of St. Louis.
City of St. Louis.
Okay.
But I think what happens is if there's a buyback program, what happens is it's not that it eliminates guns off the street. It eliminates guns out of my gun safe. So like I've got a gun that's not worth anything, basically. So I might just say, well, to create more room in my safe, I'll just take that one down and they'll give me $50 and, you know, because I don't want it anymore. But is it eliminating the guns that show up in crime? No, it's not. Wayne is number three.
First of all, my backstory was born in Southeast Texas, and my four nephews down there are all, their politics are a little to the right of Louis XIV, and but they are the most responsible people with gun ownership, and when I heard you both give your backgrounds, that most of the people that I know that are gun owners are like you in terms of their responsibility and their safety. My concern is we're not talking about you guys. You're fine. Mm-hmm. And also in background, I agree with you, the NRA, when I grew up and I did very little hunting, they were the good guys. And it was about the environment, gun safety, and having fun hunting and all that. And somehow it's morphed to whatever we got now. I'm also administrator of high school, and I never knew that I'd have to do assemblies telling people that according to the St. Louis County Police, our third option is we have to attack the shooter because he is going to kill some of us, but just to stand there is the worst of all strategies. And unless you want to do like the school in Florida, which converted their high school into a prison, basically, you cannot, you know, when parents ask me, what's going to happen if a shooter really wants to get in, I say, some people are going to die, we're going to try to minimize the damage. There's no rational, physical way to stop a sick or a bad person. It's usually going to be a sick person that would do that. I'm uncomfortable with your analogies, saying things like Hummels and artwork and comparing it to weapons, because weapons have a very, very specific function. The number one function is to protect slash hurt, kill somebody. That's their function. I don't drive an AR-15 to work. I don't slice a tomato with an AR-15. It's a very specific tool. When the Second Amendment was made, we had muzzle loaders and flintlocks. I don't think our founding fathers were thinking long in terms of what technology would do to our culture and our society and the safety of our children. And my last argument, I hope I'm being respectful, is I don't understand that this government threat of private sales. And respectfully, when I hear people from the other side of this discussion say, well, I don't trust the government, my gosh, the government is pro-NRA, it's the other side of the conversation from me. If you don't trust that government, who are you going to trust? So I totally respect both of you. You guys are fine as individuals. I just don't like the culture and the inability to go, hey, this crap is dangerous. We got to fix it. You know, and that sense of inertia from my friends that are on the other side of this argument, I find very frustrating. So, shut up.
Okay, no, well, I have a couple of comments on that. I think we could do a much better job protecting the children in school. I've traveled a lot, and there's nothing more intimidating to go into an airport and see officers there with dogs. Okay, and I think we should have a person on every school, and I think that one of the ways to detect guns and other things is to have a dog. I think that's a very intimidating thing, and I think a sort of a low-risk thing compared to what could happen. Okay, the other thing that you talked about, the guns are made to kill. They're also made to do other things, okay? So I don't know, I'm sure you all heard of Condoleezza Rice, the Attorney General under George Bush. And she very recently talked about the civil rights movement in Alabama. Okay, and she said, we had a local sheriff named Bull Halsey, and Condoleezza, of course, was in the black community. And she said, he would not protect the black community against the Ku Klux Klan. She can remember being with her father in the church, using firearms to protect themselves and their church against the Ku Klux Klan. So there's sometimes value in guns, and that's where the comment comes, I don't trust the government. There are people in the government that abuse it, and we see it all the time with some police officers. So maybe we should be more understanding and tolerant of that, but that's where that phrase comes from. There's a lot of bigotry out there. And another thing is, there's a lot of hatred in the world, as you can imagine, as you know. And you might say, well, the civil rights movement is never going to happen again, okay? Might say that. But I would ask you to think about the religious conflict we have in this country. And I could imagine that there could be an equivalent of the civil rights movement employing Christians and Muslims. I think there's a lot of hate for Muslims, which is very, very unfortunate. But that could turn into something that I think we might live through, or maybe our children would live through. So, you know, there's all kinds of aspects to it. But I come back to, we have to do more to protect our children. We really do. And I think there's ways to do that safely, or more safely. You know, nothing. There's no 100% guarantee. So,
Wayne?
Can you use this so it gets recorded? Could you each describe a gun safe, especially in terms of access for children in a home?
We advocate that?
Yeah. So
I'm just
tell them what it looks like.
Yeah. No. It's think of a metal. Mine's a metal cabinet. So mine's really small. It holds like 7-8 guns, and it has think of a rack, you know, where it sits and the gun sits up. And so mine has a metal door with a key that hooks in. It has two keys actually that hook into it. And so that's the bot. That's because I don't have that many guns. I don't have any handguns. So that's what I use. John's, I've never seen John's, but my guess is that it's a safe. So when we talk about gun safes, it really is a safe in the sense that it's got a dial and it's got like a, you know, inch or 2 inch thick door, and it weighs so much that it takes two or three people to get it into your house, and you know, and so inside your safe, then your long guns, your rifles and your shotguns sit up. And most people probably also have their handguns in a handgun safe, which is, you know, like a little case that you would lock it up, and then put your handgun in your safe. Is that what you have, a safe?
Big yeah, safe? I have a fairly large safe because I have a lot of guns, and it takes a combination.
It probably weighs.
Oh, it weighs over 2,000 pounds. Okay, so nobody can come in and take it away. Okay. Essentially, nobody can take it away.
Get into it.
Oh yes, well I mean it's got a, you know, a 5-digit combination, and it's got umpteen bolts that come out to, you know,
most people have their gun safes in the basement because they can't put it on a floor.
But say something, I don't have a small sub where I keep handguns. Not at all. I don't. It would be essentially impossible if someone broke into my house to defend myself with a gun. I'm so much more worried about my children and my grandchildren getting to the gun. So, to that extent, my son does foster care. So we had to have an inspection of our house because we wanted to, you know, sometimes babysit for these little children and these young people. And they come in and they see how you keep your guns where they are and make sure that, you know, they're safe. So, and not only do I keep all guns in the safe, I keep all my ammunition in the safe because that's, you know.
Is it your sense that the folks that also have guns also have safes like this and security? And
no, they don't.
They don't?
No. You hear about it all the time. You know, 4-year-old boy goes and got into the nightstand. There was a loaded gun. He hurt himself. Yeah, that's irresponsible behavior, absolutely.
And there's no law or requirement that you don't say?
I think for handguns, there's actually a law. Usually there's a law that they have to have. You can, so in any gun, you can get what's called a trigger lock. And so it's effectively, so think of a thing that's got a trigger where the trigger is, and there's a, what do you call it? There's a piece of metal. What do you call it? A guard.
Oh, not a guard.
And so a trigger lock is you would put one side on one side of the trigger, and then the other part hooks, just like mushes into it, and then you lock that. So you can get trigger guards. So if you had your gun not in a safe but had a trigger guard on it, you would be incapable of using it. So if you only have one or two guns, most people don't have a safe, but a lot of people have trigger guards.
Yeah. Now, well, it's required to have to sell. All new guns have to have a trigger guard. Okay. Yeah. Now, do people use them all the time? Of course not. They don't. Yeah.
It was a condition that they're coming to our house.
And I think, but what?
Go ahead.
But that, you know, one of the things that I think is important is that, and I don't want to show up hands, but one of the things that's important is, so I took, you know, a lot of you know Kate, our daughter, when she was old enough, she was probably 12 or 13 maybe, I took her out to the range and let her shoot. And it was primarily so she would understand, A, safety, just to see how we did it, and B, to shoot. And she really never wanted to do it. And we did it a couple times. We took the .22 out to a range and shot it a couple times. And it was more for her to understand what it is to shoot a gun, what it is to shoot a gun responsibly, because then when she's around people who say, well, guns kill people, and guns are unsafe. And it was like, well, no. You know, and then you know, and maybe a lot of you in here have never shot a gun. And I think there's a fear factor of guns because it's something you've never done before. But if we left here and when I took you out to the range and showed you how to shoot and properly and direct you as you, you know, you might say, oh, this is actually A, safer than I thought, and B, it's actually kind of fun. So I think part of it is that we have this fear of the unknown. You know, if you've never shot a gun, you don't know what it's like to shoot a gun. And part of it is that once you get past that, then you have a little more foundation for an argument about guns are unsafe or safe or whatever. So I think part of it's education. So to, right now, to get a as a, I don't know how old you have to be, but young people have to go through hunter safety courses before you can get a license to hunt, which when we were kids, that didn't occur. But now I think to get a license as a youngster, your boys probably went through, you have to go through hunter safety program, which is really, I think, a useful thing. So anybody out there who's hunting today, except if you're our age, any younger people, probably 40 or below, have been through hunter safety program. So at least they've been exposed to it, whether they practice it or not. It's like saying, you know, we've all been through driver's ed, but whether you drive responsibly or not, I mean, I can't say. But at least they've been exposed to the safety aspects.
I mean, I think safety has been, not done enough. We don't really press safety enough about with guns. Okay.
Wait, see, I have the mic. I need to do something. So I want to sort of go back to Dan's question for just 1 second, because I think we conflate two issues sometimes.
Yeah.
One is guns, and the other is the thing that caused someone to act violently. And so I think it's easy to blame the gun on the outcome, when the reality is that someone had a mental illness, somebody got bullied, somebody was abused, that we need to make sure that we're addressing those underlying issues that cause people to be violent, as well as the way in which people are violent. Mm-hmm. And we're never gonna fix the one issue until we fix the other. And like you suggested about the gun safety, there are short-term problems and there are long-term problems. And I think this is part of what makes me have a problem with the gun discussion, is that there's more than one conversation happening and we don't always acknowledge that.
There's one organization that has a well-worn statement. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Okay, so, but that has a two-edged sword to it, obviously. You know, you didn't have a gun, then you couldn't do it. But, and to just carry on, I believe there's a lot of displayed violence in our society, particularly in the entertainment industry. I don't know if you all go to a movies, but I would say if you look at the previews, 75% of them involve guns, for one thing or another. The second thing is these video games. Most of those are incredibly violent, and makes things, people think that, you can solve problems with a gun. And usually all it does is create problems, okay? So
the previews, by the way, if you pay attention to the summer previews in the movies, there are more of these previews with guns because there are more kids attending the movies in the summer. I have a question that's a follow-up, I think, to several things that we've talked about. We recognize you as responsible gun owners and users, concerned about gun safety. Are there people such as yourselves who have formed organizations that work for education in gun safety and also who work towards sensible gun legislation? Gun owners who advocate.
There is an alternative organization to the NRA, and I can't remember what it's called. But they are they're a pro-gun organization, so gun ownership, but they're very clear in their statement that they're not the NRA. And I can't remember what it's called now.
I hesitate to say this, but I belong to the NRA, and they spend a fairly substantial part of their budget on education, okay? So they really do, and I think they do some good. But there are so many kooks in NRA. It's disgusting. They're our own worst enemy. But I still belong to the NRA, and you might think that that's supporting the enemy, quote unquote, the enemy. But I would draw the analogy some way to the Catholic Church, which I, of course I'm a member of the Catholic Church. What's going on in the Catholic Church is absolutely abhorrent. What the priests do, what they, how they cover it up, it's just almost unforgivable, okay? Now, so there's a lot of, you know, you would say, well, why do you belong to the Catholic Church? Well, you know, you have a set of beliefs, you believe in the resurrection, you're going to say, I'm not going to let the bureaucracy change how I practice my religion. So there's some analogy, you know, to the NRA there, okay? There are some leaders, and of course a lot of people in it are what I would call not responsible. But that's not, I enjoy guns, I want to have them, and I use them, and I use with my children, so I want to have that opportunity, you know? So, before we say too much about the NRA, understand that I think there are good parts to it also.
I'm going to shout, I can't. I'd like to go back to what Gail was talking about. Number one, the psychologists are not going to be able to tell you which people are mentally ill and go to. But we do have a societal thing going on right now that enters into this, in that we have a thing that says if something bad happens, somebody's got to pay for it. And that is true in the lawsuits thing. You know, if something bad happens to me, somebody's got to pay for it. And it goes then down to the kids in the inner city. You know, you say something bad about me, I have to, out of self-respect, take care of you. And I don't know the answer to that, but I'm pretty sure that is a thing that people then come and say, well, we just got to get rid of guns in the inner city. And that might be a short-term help a little bit, but we get into a discussion about guns against that, and then you got arguments and fights and people trying to defend their turf. And we got to learn to argue, you know, but we're not looking at the right issue.
Yeah, it is, but that maybe, I don't know how to solve that, but it's hard to break that chain of community
violence.
Well,
there are some things that you can do just as long as I'm still on my soapbox. You could do a little bit better in investing in kids and families and school instead of jails and things like that. But I think until you start trying to tease apart what the issues are, instead of going for a short-term fix, I don't think you can do it. And I don't know how to do that either.
Yeah.
I'm going to change the subject. do you ever hunt? Quote, for meat, do you go deer hunting, pheasant hunting, that sort of thing? And do you do that, and do you eat what you shoot?
Yes.
I don't deer hunt. I don't hunt large animals at all.
No, I don't either. I mean, you would not, most people I know, you would not go hunting unless it was to eat what you shoot.
Sometimes how long it took us to eat an animal.
Yeah. And I enjoy it sometimes. And there are people who hunting is I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's just another friend of mine who's you know, to put people in perspective. This other friend of mine grew up in the northern the UP of Michigan, and you know, he's a Harvard PhD, and he hunts and fishes, as I do, as John does. And it's one of those things, if you grew up in that, with that environment, if you grew up with that sort of ethic, then it's really hard to explain if you never did. It's a bonding with nature. And you say, well, you can go out in nature and you don't have to shoot something. But there's, and Gail and I were talking about this, about how this was going to get around to hunting, is that it's primal. There is something primal about hunting. And it's not that, most people I know, you don't go out and just shoot as much as you can. There are some people who do, you know. But, you know, responsible hunters are, you know, hunters are really responsible for a lot of the comeback in most species that were almost extinct at one time. You know, the fact that we have an overrunning deer population, is the white-tailed deer were almost extinct a while back, and it's because of hunting organizations and hunting laws, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really hard to explain hunting to somebody that it there is a primal aspect to it. And but you would not, everybody I know, you would not shoot it unless you're going to eat it. And if you're not going to eat it yourself, like deer hunting, there are organizations you can donate the meat to, and it goes to someone else. So it nobody just goes to shoot something and leaves it laying there. Nobody who's responsible. So
my question is about that primal nature of this. In the beginning, you talked about open spaces where you go to shoot, right? You don't shoot where there's another house right by here or something like that. And the bonding aspect of it. Is there a sort of nostalgia for frontier life? In your either unconscious or conscious way of
yeah.
The next question is, there is no frontier left.
No, there is. Okay. I mean, to the extent that, so here's an example. Gail and I went to Chester, Illinois yesterday, and we went and we ate lunch in this little cafe in Chester. And Gail's comment was, I really love to get out in rural America, and then I really love to go back home. And so there is, I mean, so I grew up in Omaha, but all my relatives were on the farm, you know, and it was just, so I have sort of this rural, I'm not a, you know, I grew up in the city, but I have this connection to rural America. So there is that getting back to the land aspect. And I think that same thing is true with
that. Yeah, exactly. I mentioned earlier that I was encouraged to hunt. And the reason was very plain. It was for protein. Not being a wealthy family at all, a lot of people in the family, a lot of mouths to feed. And so that's how I got into it. And maybe it is nostalgia of that activity, I don't know. But clearly there's good reason to hunt, or at least there used to be. But it's enjoyable. It really is, particularly if you have a dog. That is a incredibly rewarding experience.
One more. Will you let Dan do one more? Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm certainly not against hunting. In fact, a good double cheeseburger works for me every day. So I'm a carnivore, so yeah. I get that. For the first time in the history of our country, more people live in cities and urban areas than farmland. Having said that, I guess my rhetorical or non-rhetorical question is, for the majority of Americans now, are guns a want or a need?
Well,
they're a want.
They're a want, except for the criminal element, it's a need.
You're talking to an economist, most Americans, so it's a want. You know, we differentiate between wants and needs.
You know, I always talk to my students about the difference between wants and needs and how that should affect my life and my decisions. And I just would respectfully suggest that discussion that element needs to be part of the discussion and the concept that, and again, I've got no problem with you guys, but for a lot of people, I don't think they realize that.
For individual right, trumps common good. Individual, I have a right, and if I've got a right, I get to exercise that, and the common good, which I think when we start talking about our schools, and at some point, if all we are is a bundle of rights, I think the country's in pretty serious trouble.
Yeah.
Thank you all. Before you leave, let me tell you about Chester, Illinois for just 1 second. The Smithsonian has an exhibit called Crossroads. It is started in Chester, Illinois. It's visiting 5 other cities in Illinois, and it's about life in rural America. It's visiting small towns in Illinois, so you might look at where else it's going. It was pretty interesting. Next week, we're continuing this conversation by talking to an organization, which I think of as Moms. I know that's not actually the name of it, but that's kind of how they advertise themselves. And they're going to talk about their approach to gun legislation. And I think it's a very nice group. You will enjoy it. I won't be here because my mother broke her leg. And so I'm going back to Arkansas yet again. But please join us. Please thank the two of them.